to today's Thanksgiving, and I think reflecting on the just the effort that people have made to come to a 10-day retreat over Thanksgiving, it's a very different way of celebrating Thanksgiving than most people out there. Although I only have, vicarious access to what people do in America on Thanksgiving. My perception of Thanksgiving is either people come to a 10-day retreat at the Angela Center or they come to the monastery. That's how I experience Thanksgiving. So it's sometimes a very different world. But to acknowledge and to bring up the feelings of gratitude for the opportunity to be here. Of course, that's what, ostensibly Thanksgiving is about, is a giving of thanks, a acknowledgement of gratitude. And as Dhamma practitioners, it's really an important quality to be cultivating and to be bringing up into the mind, because it provides a different standard of measurement for our experience. It's like the old and well-worn image of the glass that's half empty or half full. It depends how you perceive it. And so that feeling of, oh my God, it's half empty, it's almost gone. Or, wow, isn't that great? It's half full. The object of a perception is exactly the same. But the feeling is very, very different. So that being able to consciously direct attention to and strengthen those perceptions of gratitude are the things that help us to really perceive ourselves and the world around us very, very differently. And I remember very early days of probably within the first year of establishing Wat Nana Chat, the international monastery in Thailand. And the village that we established it in those days was still, there wasn't really a decent road access to the village. So it was quite poor. Northeast of Thailand in those days was considered very, very poor. And we were sitting around doing some kind of work or preparing something with one of the regular villagers that came to the monastery. And I remember him saying just this sort of offhand statement, talking about living there and his life's circumstance, and just sort of saying, I don't have any money, but I'm not poor. And it was really striking, because he didn't really have that much money, so there's his stability of his external circumstances weren't all that much to talk about. But he really recognized that feeling of poverty and lack is a state of mind. He is very interesting, because there was a group of the Bungwai is the village where Wat Nana Chat is, and there was a whole group of those villagers who used to walk over to Wat Papong on the lunar observance days. They'd walk over early in the morning, and sort of back roads, and then they would get in time for offering the meal, which the meal offering's at 8, so they'd have to start off, you know, at dawn, before dawn, and to walk over. They'd do the meal offering, spend the day and the night at the monastery, listen to Dhamma talks, practice meditation, do the chanting, and then after morning chanting, the next morning, walk back to Bung Wai village. And he started going, and he was getting interested, and he had a doubt that, you know, how can I really practice these Buddhist teachings? How can they apply to me? How can I keep precepts as just an ordinary person? It didn't seem to be fit with my life, especially as a farmer, and the lifestyle in northeast of Thailand is, especially in the old days, it was really like hunter-gatherer type, and most of your vegetables came from the forest around, and you planted things like garlic and chilies and a couple spices. That's where you had a little garden by your house, and then you collected your vegetables out in nature, and then you kind of hunted anything that moved. You get some very strange things in your alms bowl. I said, you know, how can I keep precepts? And especially that first precept, I don't see how I could survive. And talking to Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah said, if you really want to keep the precepts, you come here and stay here, and I'll teach you a livelihood. And he did that. And Ajahn Chah taught him herbal medicines. And then he learned all sorts of, you know, herbal medicines, herbal treatment is sort of. And then he became a herbalist who treated people. And he got to be well known all in that area, and particularly in the circle of students and disciples, branch monasteries of Wat Bapong. And he would oftentimes get invited to go off to distant villages to treat different people. So it was always, especially as a herbalist, a village doctor, then on a certain level, it's kind of like a monk, because what you do is you give and you help and do what you can, and then people will look after you as best they can. Yeah, and that's how he ended up, you know, living his life, you know, keeping the precepts, meditating. And of course, you know, he had tremendous gratitude to Ajahn Chah for that opportunity to live in that way. And that whole perception of, you know, not being poor. He never really knew when he was going to have an income. He never really knew what it was going to be. But he had integrity, and he had his own heart that knew enough. So that sense of gratitude isn't just a quality of, you know, being. It comes from that sense of understanding and appreciating the things that we do have, and not getting caught in the cycle of desire and longing for what we don't have. And that can be on a material level, it can be on a level of, you know, personality, temperament, it can be on the level of kind of skills and attributes of the intellect. It covers everything. So that sense of a recognition of not being poor in any way. Oftentimes in Thailand, the teachers will always say, you know, you people who've come to practice the Dhamma, keep precepts, study the Buddhist teachings, you're incredibly fortunate. You've got your faculties, you've got your life force, you've got enough to be able to, it's, you say that is that in itself is enough for one's well-being. And when one reflects back, especially holding it with that quality of gratitude. Because again, that sense of, you know, there's always the feel, and there's always the feeling of not enough. And especially when we think in terms of spiritual practice, you know, once we're, you know, we're actually fairly well off materially, you know, then our desires go out and they take a different form. Especially as practitioners, there was a story of a person who came to pay respects to Ajahn Buddhadasa, great monk in the south of Thailand, and you know, with this kind of burning spiritual question and quest, part of the quest, spiritual quest, you know, wanting to, you know, kind of get ahead in the practice, and you know, asking, you know, what do I need to develop, and what do I need to rely on in order to realize the highest truths of Buddhism? You know, what do I have to cultivate? What do I have to develop? What is it that I need? And Ajahn Buddhadasa just sort of laughed and said, you know, all you need is the interest that brought you here to ask the question in the first place. You've got it all. Learn how to recognize it. Learn how to realize it. Learn how to, you know, to rely on that. Because you have that tendency to always be looking for, you know, that's the nature of desire. It's the feeling of I don't have enough, and if I only had something else, that would fulfill me. And, you know, whether it's our health or whether it's our, you know, our life circumstances, it's just the nature of desire to be going out and seeking an object. And then the feeling that we feel when desire goes out seeking for an object is we feel lack. And that's how it works. It's sort of, it's like, when you don't eat, then you feel hungry. I mean, it's just sort of nature, how nature works. So it's that recognizing that those characteristics of the human condition, and turning attention to the qualities that allow a sense of well-being and just a kind of wholesome fullness to arise. And you know, this is where gratitude really plays a role, because it's not intellectually we can't say, oh, I've got enough. We have to learn how to direct attention to the heart and bring up a feeling of appreciation, of gratitude, of a recognition of our capability, and and you're being able to use circumstances for our benefit. Remember talking to one woman I know who was a very solid practitioner, and she was in a real horrible car accident, almost died, left with kind of back injuries, and I remember going to visit her many times, but as she was really starting, her recuperation period was going good, but she was really left with a lot of chronic pain. And she said, I'm really grateful for this, what this has done, because it's really pushed me to investigate how to separate out the my reactions to the actual sensation. And you know, think, whoa, okay, that's that's pretty serious, because it's when the mind, again, it's sort of that, okay, half empty or half full. And it isn't just a kind of a Pollyanna-ish type of, oh, isn't life wonderful? And sort of, but there's always, one can always turn our attention in a way that we can benefit. And like in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha, sort of says, it wasn't until I saw the Four Noble Truths in their three phases and their 12 aspects that I was able to declare that I was fully awakened and all of that. But there's also discourses where the Buddha frames his liberating insight in different ways. And one of the ways that he frames it is, it wasn't until I saw the drawback in things as a drawback. It wasn't until I saw the benefit of things in phenomena, external and internal, as a benefit. And it wasn't until I saw the way out, the escape, as the escape, that I could declare myself as fully awakened. And just that kind of reflection of being able to turn attention to something. There's a drawback. There's a limitation. There's a painful side to this. There's a benefit. There's something that can be drawn out of it. That's good, useful, helpful. And there's an escape from all of it. There's a release from all of it. So being able to reflect and that using the quality of gratitude is a helpful way of not being pulled down by the things that have the potential of being a drawback. But then also that it helps to enhance the qualities that are truly beneficial and we easily overlook or forget or neglect, or it becomes ordinary because we're surrounded by it. Yeah, that cultivation and attention to gratitude is it's an important part of our practice. As we cultivate and develop the path, it actually increasingly relies on an internal stability and well-being in order to see clearly. And that can't be forced, it can't be imposed on the mind, or it can't be just an idealized concept. It has to come up within the heart. So that's where qualities like gratitude and the opportunities for wholesome perspective allow that kind of stability and well-being, an ease within the human condition. And then, with that as a basis, then it facilitates that clear seeing and clear understanding of the nature of the conditions that we live in as a human being. As one of the main reflections or bases of insight, and the characteristics of insight are those insights into anicca dukkha anatta, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. But that kind of insight and reflection isn't just a negative assessment of one's miserable existence. From that place of well-being and kind of security and trust, then one can allow that that reality of the impermanent, changeable, uncertain, inconstant nature of experience to be present, then something else arises out of the heart. I mean, it's like again in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, that where the insight of Anya Kondanya, of Kondanya, and which is the kind of the stock phrase describing the insight into stream entry, whatever has the nature to arise, that has the nature to cease. And you think, well, that's pretty ordinary. But the result of really taking that in, and again, where the heart is clear, steady, trusting, stable because of its, that reliance on wholesome qualities like gratitude, but also virtue and the allowing the mind to unify. So often what we try to do is force the mind to unify. We want to get samadhi. We want to get insight. And we don't allow it to manifest. We don't trust it. We're trying to control it, trying to make it happen. But that insight arises when we're really able to set aside the agendas of me and the agendas of our own preference, attachment. And then it becomes manifest. And as they say, the insight is pretty ordinary. Whatever arises passes away. If you skip over that, it's poof, big deal. But the change that takes place when we recognize that uncertain, unstable, inherently unsatisfactory. If that's where we put all our bets on for our well-being and happiness and our sense of a fulfilled self, then it's a bad bet. allowing that to become clear to us, it takes a certain trust, and that quality of clarity is an increased ability to not take exception to the nature of conditions, not try to control to get it one's way, not to try to own it in any way. It's just, that is the way things are. It's like this. And that's Ajahn Sumedho's refrain over so many years. It's like this. To be able to, it's like this. And this is where, that quality of not clinging, not attachment, relinquishment, letting go, comes from that place, being able to be present, to realize it, to trust in that. There's a teaching that the Buddha gives, a very short and pithy, and of course, everybody here is meditators, practitioners, and I heard lots of Dhamma talks, and there's always the reference to the Buddha's instruction on how to deal with sloth and torpor, sleepiness, to Venerable Mahamoggallana. Most people have heard it, read it themselves, or seen it, heard it in Dhamma talks. But that's an excerpt from a longer discourse. And after instructing Mahamoggallana on dealing with drowsiness in his meditation, and then he gives him instruction on how to, basically how to live as a samana, as a religious seeker, in the way that one can shed the burden of self, and how to interact with people, particularly the lay community. And then Mahamoggallana asks for instruction on like a, can I get a short teaching on the kind of the essence of the teaching? And the Buddha gives this very short phrase in Pali, Sambheda Manalang Abhinivesaya, and it means, nothing is worth clinging to, basically. Or, no phenomena are worth attaching to. Nothing should be adhered to. And the Buddha says, if you know this much, then you know everything. If you understand this, you understand everything. So that sense of, something short and pithy, and that's enough to take into our practice and to not allow not to get caught and hooked by the mind that loves to make a story out of something. We love our stories, but just not adhering, not clinging, not attaching to. Which again is not this sort of what do they call it? It's a psychological term, spiritual bypass, where one doesn't have to bother taking responsibility for oneself, and we get, I'm just letting go of it. Either on a external duty, internal responsibility, and commitment to precepts and training, sort of aim, one uses the spiritual bypass of, nothing's worth clinging to anyway, so I can do what I want. It's not really how it works. But seeing that with wisdom, seeing it with real discernment and living it. So there's reflections on anicca, dukkha, anatta. It's such a integral part of how to direct the heart to something that has some essence to it. In the sense of an essence of insight and knowledge. And of course, it's on a certain level, paradoxically, by looking at the unstable, unsatisfactory, non-self nature of things. And that's how you get to an essence. Ajahn Chah gives some very beautiful images of the... he said, it's like when we're... reflect and understand anicca, dukkha, anatta. He said, it's like the difference between ordinary knowledge and insight knowledge. That sense that ordinary knowledge is pretty shallow, but when we have real insight with that anicca, dukkha, anatta, he said, it's like the difference between having a bottle of water and having a spring that is constantly supplying you with water. There's an endless supply of water from that spring. And with just a bottle of water, and it didn't take very long for it to run out. But when you've got a spring that you can go to, you keep refilling your bottle. Another image that Ajahn Chah uses is the being by the seashore. And for Ajahn Chah, the seashore was pretty exotic. The northeast of Thailand is kind of a dry plain, far away from any seashore. And being by the seashore and seeing the waves coming into the seashore, and sort of coming from afar, coming in, and just coming, and said all those waves that come in from the sea, they come in and they hit the shore and they go back again, and those waves are, that's a manifestation of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not-self. This is always happening. But the seashore is there to receive it all. And that's when we're willing to reflect and investigate on that anicca, dukkha, anatta, then we're able to receive that. But that's a place of stability and solid ground that we stay with, we rely on. Allow the waves to come in and the waves to go back out again. And so that, again, not taking exception to, not fearing, not getting confused by, because they're just waves of anicca, dukkha, anatta. We have the ability to know, to understand, to discern clearly, and to keep returning to that, keep allowing that to be a basis for one's awareness, attention, and it's happening around us all the time. And there's our, again, that all things have the nature to arise and have the nature to cease is not some kind of divine knowledge that has to be bestowed on you. It's not some sort of hidden esoteric knowledge that you have to get some kind of transmission for. It's not something that is so extraordinarily refined that you have to do something amazingly special. It's learning how to pay attention to the ordinary around us, but looking at it with a different quality of heart, experiencing it with a quality of awareness, a quality of brightness, trust, gratitude, all of these qualities together. And I think of the canon, there's a very beautiful description of the nun Patachara, and she's coming back from outside, going into her dwelling place, and as is the case in Asia, India in that time, Thailand even now mostly, when you come into a building, you wash your feet. There'd be places, vessels of water outside, and you wash your feet. So that it's a very ordinary activity. You do every, whenever you go into your whatever building or dwelling place. But she took a dipper of water. I mean, she'd been meditating and practicing. Took a dipper of water and washing your feet to go in, and then she's watching the water. Of course, there's a whole dipper full, but then it starts to run off, and then it disappears, runs off and disappearing into the ground. And then that, just impermanence, change, cessation. And that really stirred the mind to a reflective, insightful mode, came in to her hut to sit in meditation, and as she got settled, then taking her lamp and then just plucking out putting out the flame of the lamp with pulling out the wick, and that was enough for her insight into release. It was her awakening moment, her description of her enlightenment. Yeah, so these are activities that, they're ordinary activities, but they're held in a very different way. So that as we go about our day, to take an interest in these different activities, see the characteristics, experience the feel of it, allow the texture of experience to manifest, and then to allow a release, a letting go, that non-attachment to manifest.